want to open up your Bible or open up your phone, which still bothers me, even though I'm technically young, whatever word that means. But 1 Samuel chapter 8 is where we begin. We're looking at the life of Samuel in a new chapter, and I particularly appreciate. I just went on, Mark.
That's fine.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah, let me interrupt myself. Remember that we have Invoke. And there's a prayer guide. Are these available somewhere close?
Down in the foyer.
Down in the foyer, you can get a guide for the Invoke prayer event that they do every year. If you've not signed up for a slot, be sure to do that.
So you have people to sign you up. She needs people.
We need people to get this running the way they like to run it, where every hour is covered.
We're having trouble getting people at 2 a.m., 3 a.m.
2 a.m., 3 a.m., 4 a.m.
It's easy slots.
It's the normal day slots, probably.
Yeah,
that are actually most difficult.
Daytime.
Yeah, that's not surprising. So, Invoke, okay, down in the foyer. And we'll just leave this right here if you want to see it. I appreciate Nancy covering things as well last week. We had a little bit of miscommunication, Mark and I, and that's normal for me, so don't worry about that. But she showed me a little picture of, she asked you a question. And said, what are you getting out of, what are you hearing in this class? I think that's what she said. And so she was over on campus last week, and she showed me that little 5 or 6 words that you put up on the board. And I just thought that was fabulous. And I don't even have them with me. But what you said in that whiteboard was basically you're seeing God is actually interested in us. That he's available to be heard. That he's trying to speak into our lives and that he's ever active. So it's nice when you see input like that without asking for it. So that was lovely. I just want to compliment you on that. 1 Samuel chapter 8. Let's get going with the life of Samuel. Remember last time we were together a couple weeks ago, we were getting a picture of Samuel as a young boy where he is in the house of Eli, this prophet house, this role that is kind of like a judge and prophet combined. And his mother is offering him to this household and he experiences a call of God. In the middle of that environment, if you remember, Eli and his sons, they were not particularly respectable people. And that's a nice texture to the story, because it's going to come out here in just a minute. But that Samuel was put into a house that we would say is not exactly the ideal adoption center for a child. Especially when the mother is trying to bring the child and covenant the child to the purposes of God. Samuel experiences, come on in, yes, no worries, make us much, yeah, good, good, yeah, pull apart. Samuel is experiencing this, from the inception, reconciling a house in ill repute, so to speak, with his own calling. And we talked about that experience of hearing the voice of God, that three-time repetition. It's Eli even saying, hey, that's the Lord talking, go and find out what that means, remember all of that? So that's going to be useful as we come into this chapter because there's going to be an echo of that story now in this late stage of Samuel's life. So as I typically do, I want to go ahead and read the passage with you, invite you to listen into this and see what you detect about the story, and then we'll take a look at that. If we have time today and we finish up our discussion on Samuel, we'll then move to David. And to give you a sense of where I would like to go just for the time that we have left, I'll probably stay till the end of spring, I think, which is May-ish, end of May. And we'll do a little bit more time. I want to use David as a study of a king who hears God. I want to do a prophet that's one of the major prophets, so you can kind of get a couple experiences with that. And then we'll jump into the New Testament, talk about Jesus himself. We'll talk about maybe one of the disciples, maybe Paul. And then I want to have a little bit of space to talk about today's experience of God speaking. Now that we have all these narratives moving around, and we can kind of say, maybe how has this changed the way we maybe perceive God acting in our lives, letting these stories shape us? So that's what's left of the class as we look forward. But let's go to 1 Samuel chapter 8. And I'm going to read this in its entirety. There's about 22 verses, so listen to the little moves and nuances. One of the great things about the Old Testament, it has an oral tradition that still is present in the written text, and you can hear that when I read it. So just listen to the way the text kind of warp and move to it, and what's important in it, and then we'll talk about it. So when Samuel grew old, he appointed his sons as judges for Israel. The name of his firstborn was Joel, and the name of his second was Abijah, and they served at Beersheba. But his sons did not walk in his ways. They turned aside after dishonest gain and accept bribes and perverted justice. So all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. They said to him, "You are old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint us a king to lead us, such as all the other nations have." But when they said, "Give us a king to lead us," this displeased Samuel. So he prayed to the Lord. And the Lord told him, "Listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me as their king. As they have done from the day I brought them up out of Egypt until this day, forsaking me and serving other gods, so they are doing to you. Now listen to them, but warn them solemnly and let them know what the king who will reign over them will do." Samuel told all the words of the Lord to the people who were asking him for a king. He said, "This is what the king who will reign over you will do. He will take your sons and make them serve with his chariots and horses, and they will run in front of his chariots. Some he will assign to be commanders of thousands and commanders of fifties, and others to plow his ground and to reap his harvest, and still others to make weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers and cooks and bakers. He will take the best of your fields and vineyards and olive groves and give them to his attendants. He will take a tenth of your grain and of your vintage and give it to his officials and attendants. Your men servants and maid servants and the best of your cattle and donkeys he will take for his own use. He will take a tenth of your flocks, and you yourselves will become his slaves. When that day comes, you will cry out for relief from the king you have chosen, and the Lord will not answer you in that day." But the people refused to listen to Samuel. "No," they said, "we want a king over us. Then we will be like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and fight our battles." When Samuel heard all that the people said, he repeated it before the Lord. The Lord answered, "Listen to them and give them a king." Then Samuel said to the men of Israel, "Everyone go back to his town." All right. So we're talking about Samuel in the final season of his, you want to call it a career, his identity with the nation of Israel as a judge, in this moment with the people in a major transition. A transition of how they think about themselves, how they think about truth, how they think about power, how they think about relating to God. All of this is now on the table in this chapter. So, tell me in the reading what things jumped out to you when Samuel and God are interacting, or as Samuel then carries the word of God to the people. What things pop out there in the text? What strikes you?
God is hurt.
Yeah, there is that sense. God is hurt. Hurts a God doesn't sound very what's the right word? What's the injury like for God in this? What does he feel? Try to get into God's head a little bit. I know that's probably not a wise thing.
Rejection.
Yeah, rejection. So the hurt has a sense of rejection to it.
My version is crushed.
Trust?
Crushed.
Crushed. Okay, long, strong language. Crushed.
Repetitive.
Repetitive.
Tells them it happened.
We've been here before, right? He goes all the way back to the story, right? For those of you with a mother that was less than healthy, do you remember a moment when you did something wrong, and then how does the mother explain to you what you did to her? You know, "I gave birth to you." Well, this was my mother anyways. And she's listening right here. She's down in Florida. Mom. You guys want to say hello to my mother? She loves her. But true enough, there is this sense of God saying, "This is not any different. We are family. I am the Father. You are my children. This is the way you've always been." So that repetitive quality to it.
I'd say frustrated. Right.
Frustrated. Okay. What else? What else is just a little bit more with how God is feeling, because that helps us understand Samuel a little bit, doesn't it?
I think how God told him to warn him. He said, "Do it solemnly."
Yeah, Yeah, solemnly. Good. That was a powerful word in the text.
It's not how we would do it, you know. We'd probably get pretty upset with our folks, and it wouldn't be a solemn.
Yeah. So Samuel is asked to pull back and say, when you communicate with them, do it in such a way that they feel the gravity of what they're asking for. And that helps us understand all those descriptors in there, right? Because you may think you're asking for more freedom in the sense that that king's out in front of you, but what's that king going to do?
Oppress you.
He's going to oppress you. He's going to enslave not just you, but where does the text turn attention?
Children.
To your children. So you're asking for something that you yourself won't necessarily feel the brunt of, but the people after you will. That's sort of interesting, yeah.
I have a question, but after you're done with this point.
Yeah, sure. Well, you can have it right now. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah.
Yeah, no worries. What strikes me, and it, I don't know if it's just the way that it's written here, or this is actually how it is. But when they say, no, we want a king over us, or yep. A king to rule over us, they won't be the same as all the other nations. Yep. I have two thoughts that hit me. One is, it sounds like an immature child.
Good, yeah.
The other one is, what is it that they see in other nations? Mm-hmm. What is it that draws them to the conclusion that they want a king? What is it about what they see?
Yeah, good.
That gives them that idea. Is it are they bedazzled by the pomp and circumstance and all the flashy things when the king comes to visit them, or
the pomp and circumstance, so to speak, or the power that's around that?
Right. Or is there something else that's going on with them?
Yeah, they clearly feel a sense of difference. And that when you put Samuel up against kings of the other nation, it doesn't look the same. Samuel's got to remember we talked about those three roles a couple weeks ago. You put Samuel up there, he's doing something functionally that the Israelites are saying, no, we want this other thing over here that Samuel doesn't do necessarily. And then, what are they attracted to? I think that's a great question. What do you think a king, Michelle, I see you going, yeah, go ahead.
I think people needing to make a rupture.
Say again?
People needed to make a rupture with someone.
Mm-hmm. Rupture? Rupturing what?
So they make rupture with, relational rupture with someone.
Mm-hmm. With Samuel?
Yes.
To kind of cut it?
Uh-huh.
They're saying, Samuel, and this is probably much of what the text is setting up, right?
Yes.
Why do they go to talk to Samuel? Because? He's the head, but what else is in the text? This is why I pointed at it before I started. His sons are doing what?
They're
not just. So you could say Israel's saying, hey, we have reason.
Yeah.
We have reason here to make a change. And I want to keep poking on this because it's really interesting in the text. But Michelle, yeah, you're right on. So they're trying to say, we need a break.
Yeah.
We need a break with this thing that's happening here, Samuel. Mm-hmm. Break with the judge. Or the tradition of the judge. Okay. Yeah, over here.
I think, just kind of building on to what he was saying, I think there's a little bit of the grass is greener on the other side mentality.
Is that where you're going to?
That idea that they see the problems because it's their system and they can see them because they're close enough, but they don't see the problems of the king and they won't take God's word for it.
Yeah. It's like Brexit. It's like this isn't working. And the only other thing we know is that, so yeah. Let's not do this anymore. And yeah. The only other option that we can conceive is that.
Boy, I really want to avoid this conversation. There is a, in our day and time, we should probably at least float the idea that when people gather in a collective wisdom, when there is an atmosphere of injustice, that it's quite rare that they work through that in a just way. I'm just telling you, I think that's kind of how it usually plays. In other words, when we sense that things are corrupt, we don't have those instincts that say, this is the way out of corruption. Usually what happens is what we want to do in corruption is get power so that who's in control of the corruption?
We are.
Yeah, exactly right. So Brexit in some way, kind of, and being over in England just a month or two ago, we were actually kicking around Brexit And it's fun to do it on that side of the pond. With guys that are in the intellectual community and all that stuff going, we don't know what's going on. But there is this sense of isolating on an idea and saying, it's so bad, at least I can have control of the bad, however that might play. And that's the solemn quality there, isn't it? In other words, Samuel, when you go to them, get the tone right. You think you want this, but your sons and daughters are going to pay the price. And it doesn't matter in their logic.
Don't you think part of it, too, they say, then we'll be like all the other nations. Our king will judge us. He will go out with us and fight our battles.
Yep.
Samuel didn't go out and fight with them. He offered sacrifices. He was the one that prayed to God. He can go into battle.
Well, he had a little bit of military. If you read backward a little bit, he does have some kind of, the Philistines can't quite make ground. So he does have a military function. It's okay. Not quite like the way a king
it's
would
It's not like a king would.
No, which is what we see when we read past this moment in the story and we get the David and Goliath thing. Mm-hmm. That's what they're thinking about. Like, here's the great warrior. Where's our great warrior? Where's our guy? We don't have that. And of course, this also gives credence to why does Saul become attractive? Because he's Saul be tall, right? I mean, Saul stands above. He kind of looks powerful. And yet, the story even there, we're not going to go there, but the story with Saul is he has no foundation. He has no foundation. So even though you recognize something you think is power, God says, I understand power. And you're looking in the wrong place. You're looking here. You should be looking at the heart, which will help us with David here in a few minutes.
You know, when you asked, what did they see in a king? I thought of chapter 9.
Yeah.
Saul.
Yeah.
And that's what they saw in a king was strength, good looks, whatever was in their mind, what a king was. And we're no different today. Mm-hmm. We're no different today. You know, you can't be a leader in the political world unless you're have flair, power, strength.
Yeah.
And for many, our president is the king.
Yeah.
You know, for many.
In some ways, he symbolizes a culmination of those values put together. Yeah.
And what people want is for that person to dictate the way everybody should behave.
In some ways, and I don't want to do political theology this is kind of how it plays, right? We want to select a person we believe to be powerful because we believe by selecting them that when they talk and create policy or action, it's going to become powerful like they're powerful. So by residual effect, I become powerful because I've chosen the powerful figure. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah.
This is just political logic, that's all. Yeah. It's one of the reasons why ugly people don't win, right? Or short people don't win.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, they don't, truly.
Calvin in there says they're rejecting me as the king.
Yeah.
God was the king of Israel.
Yeah.
And he took them through many things, you know, especially taking them out of Egypt, and he mentions that. And he says they want to have somebody that they can touch.
They want a tangible, right?
Right. They don't pick the prophets. God picked the prophets.
True enough.
They don't pick all these other things. They want some involvement.
Yeah, so, give us, we'll select.
Right, so God says, okay, it's the only way you're going to get these people to do anything is to go ahead with them.
Well, go ahead, Steve. Yeah.
Well, I think all of this goes back to, though, a deeper thought, which is, I think, is why was God hurt the rejection? Ultimately, who do we trust? Because God, the people only trust, and we only trust that which we can see. We operate in the physical. We don't operate in the spiritual.
Yeah.
Our first inclination is always to go to what do I see in the physical versus in the spiritual. And I think God basically says, you don't trust me.
Yeah. And that's been kind of the, even with the great miracles of Exodus, one of the, and this is so appropriate to the church, memory fades. You can be in a good season as a church, but that memory has a very short shelf life. You have to have this undergirding commitment to the purposes of God that when those seasons come and go, that's the stabilizing force, right? So that's why the church can experience tremendous Acts 2 explosion and then horrible persecution and still be the same church. and not be feeling like their identity has now been suffered or threatened. It only gets intensified because of their commitments to discipleship. So in some ways, yeah, we're seeing what is most familiar, most accessible to the people of Israel. That's the thing they want to go to and they want to create. I want to make one bend, because what we're trying to also pick up in the text is Samuel's experience of God speaking. So not so much the outward manifestation of how that plays, but let's talk a little bit about Samuel receiving this message.
I can't help but think that Samuel goes into this discussion with God greatly disappointed. But at first, from his standpoint, that is to say, that he kind of goes crying to God saying, they've rejected me. God says, no, they rejected me. They reject you. They rejected me.
Yeah, that's good. So God, here's one key to write what you're talking about. God reframes. This is a big activity of God. When God is speaking into our lives, one of the things that he does is he reframes.
Right.
He says, no, if your heart is like my heart, let me show you how to see this differently. Now, if your heart's not like God's, or you don't know how to identify with God and his nature, it's hard for you to experience a reframing with God, because the value systems can't communicate. But Samuel seems to be, in the text, broken as God would be broken. And so God says, because you can do that, because you can hear that, let me show you that what you're seeing can be understood this way. Okay, so reorientation.
One thing that I found interesting in this is that God didn't say, get control of your son. He said, cut them out, give the people a king, let's start over this way.
Yeah, this is really interesting to me. Especially in light that Samuel did not have this experience as a young boy, the sense of the sons and the corrective and all of that. And here, there's nothing to address the injustice in the house of the judge. But it's a turn. Yeah, let's poke on that just a little bit more. Do you think Samuel cared about his sons taking the role that he had?
She might have been too close.
Sure, and then might be too close, maybe. I do care, but maybe I can't make a corrective.
And I think he probably felt like a failure.
Do you mean Eli? No, I'm talking about Samuel and his sons, Joel and Abijah. Yeah, sure, we'll go with Abijah.
Because any Christian parent wants to be able to pass on their faith and their values and their heritage.
Yeah, yeah.
And maybe their ministry, you know, they want their children to embrace those things.
Yeah.
And that's something you can't control. It has to be their choice. So.
Yeah, and I don't want to read too much into the text, but boy, it's just there is a big softball, isn't it? I mean, it's just sitting there out in the open in the clouds. Sam, you have no ground to talk about legacy.
Right.
It's not available. Your story will be, Samuel, that your sons have failed. And not only that, Samuel, the end of the judges comes with you. I mean, feel that in the text. It's kind of woven in there, right? It's woven into kind of how Samuel's experiencing this. And we're thinking about contemporary application of this. Have you had a temptation with some part of your life that is out of control to put it in kind of a little box and say, well, I still need to go be spiritual over here? I think this text has something to say about that. And that, boy, hands are flying. Good. Yeah, I'm not ignoring it. And that God speaks in the middle of either paradox or irreconcilable situations. Like, he doesn't just jump on one end of the seesaw and say, only when the seesaw does this do I speak. But I'm going to go ahead and speak while you got both of this happening. Okay, two comments here.
I was just thinking, Samuel, as a parent and a judge, may be brilliant as a judge.
I want to give him a little street cred on this, that he was raised in a dysfunctional home.
Yes.
We give him a little bit of
that's
on double fold, all right?
Yes.
Number one, mom hands him off and says, go be a judge. we'll see you later. That does have an effect on somebody, I think, as much as you may want to say otherwise. And then also, he learned family and leadership in the house of Eli.
Right.
So I think it's a fair touch to say there may be legacy here, to say, this model and what Samuel has available is not going to get it to happen. But I think it's in the text. I think it's buried in there to listen to Samuel. God's still speaking.
Yes.
God doesn't walk away from Samuel and say, you dysfunctional boob, I can't talk to you. He says, let me speak. And I trust you still. And I know that that's there. But you're still going to speak for me.
I think this also, Frank, a bit like the entire story, that we think God needs our help. So we keep kind of re-entering onto the stage saying, let me take over this.
That's right, yeah.
I think I can do this better.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think that's what the people of Israel are doing yet again.
Yeah, that's right.
Is just saying, we can do this
better. And that story continues just to jump all the way to Jesus. Does Jesus fix this problem? Here's the guy that's the Son of God. Does he fix this problem with people trying to take the reins? If anything, he enters into that world and submits to it through the cross to say, I don't know how else to show you the power. Even in his own disciples who were jockeying around and saying, I've got a better way to do this. Let's grab some swords. We'll chop some heads. I mean, it'll go great. Say, no. The cross is the way that you understand my
power. Well, I was just going to add that Samuel learns how to listen to God also from Eli. And so in the same way that he sees the brokenness of that family and he sees the children disobey their father and he sees their father, in fact, he's the instrument of God telling Eli,
yes,
you are being judged because of your failure to control your sons.
Yeah.
That is at that same moment when Eli says to him, it's God speaking, go listen to him. So he's seeing both brokenness
and responsiveness.
Responsiveness from the same broken person.
Yeah, that's good.
And I think that that's beautiful.
Yeah, I think it's in the text. I mean, I think it's available to consider.
When you step back, just further back, whatever he does, we're going to need a king. I don't say we need a king. Having a king is part of the narrative of where Jesus comes from.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's interesting how you try your best, you do what you do, and this is happening, and God is speaking, but how much control does Samuel have in this? Because the truth is, Jesus is coming through David's line.
Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah, and it's hard when we're Christians to read softly in the New Testament.
Yeah.
But I would say this: is it important for Samuel to speak when God speaks to him?
Yeah.
Don't miss that. In other words, he's not a pass-through. This is a testimony of Samuel's life to say, watch a man of God speak when he's spoken to. Watch how he's connected to the heart of God. Watch how he breaks and moves with that. Because that's going to inform your own faith journey. Zane, you want to go?
No, I'm good.
Okay. Something over here? I'm sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
He spoke to where Jesus has come. He always again.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's right. That's right. All right, should we move to David, or should we want to pick on Samuel? Yeah, we've got a little time for David. We want to go to the young boy? The young boy? 1 Samuel chapter 17 is where I want to go. And I want to start at verse 20, so we'll skip some of the detail there. I'm going to break this into three sections, so if we stop on a section, we can pick up in the chapter next week. But just to kind of let you hear this shift in the narrative. So now, just before this chapter, Samuel finds David. David is not the expected choice, if you remember the walkthrough of the sons, where they're kind of presenting himself to the judge, and then the ruddy boy comes along and smells like sheep poo. And he comes in, oh, that's the one, there he is. However Samuel was able to perceive that or understand that, the text is pretty clear that God waits on the small one.
Who says God doesn't have a says it?
I think it's great, yeah. And particularly when you read the whole narrative of David. Maybe one of these other sons had their act together more than David did. I mean, there's all kinds of wonderful complexity in the story. It is probably the cherished narrative of the Old Testament, the story of David and what it's about. And it's got beauty in it. I want to start at verse 20, and I want to take us down to verse 31 of 17. 1 Samuel 17, 20 through 31. So he has this commission by his father to take some food down to the brothers. That's the occasion. They're down in the valley watching the battle take place. So that's where we're starting to walk into the story. Early in the morning, David left the flock with a shepherd, loaded up, and set out as Jesse had directed. He reached the camp as the army was going out to its battle positions, shouting the war cry. Israel and the Philistines were drawing up their lines, facing each other. David left his things with the keeper of supplies, ran to the battle lines, and greeted his brothers. As he was talking with them, Goliath, the Philistine champion from Gath, stepped out from his lines and shouted his usual defiance, and David heard it. When the Israelites saw the man, they all ran from him in great fear. Now the Israelites have been saying, "Do you see how this man keeps coming out? He comes out to defy Israel. The king will give great wealth to the man who kills him. He will also give him his daughter in marriage and will exempt his father's family from taxes in Israel." David asked the men standing near him, "What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and removes this disgrace from Israel? Who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God?" They repeated to him what they had been saying and told him, "This is what will be done for the man who kills him." When Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, he burned with anger at him and asked, "Why have you come down here? And with whom did you leave those few sheep in the desert? I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. You came down only to watch the battle." "Now what have I done?" said David. "Can't I even speak?" He then turned away to someone else and brought up the same matter, and the men answered him as before. What David said was overheard and reported to Saul, and Saul sent for him. All right, that's great stuff. So we're listening for the way God and David interact. What do you notice in this setup of the story that jumps out to you in terms of interesting or sets the stage maybe for what we're about to see? What did you notice?
I think David's confident in who he is, even though an older brother calls him out.
Yeah. So is this a good confidence or a bad confidence?
I personally see it as good.
You think it's good? Okay. Anybody see it as bad confidence? Or maybe not as good?
Just good. We'll call it good. It's fine.
My Bible said, the brother said, "I know about your pride and deceit." And then I thought, oh, he's a man of God. The man after God's own heart. That part struck me. I thought of the man after God's own heart.
Well, and with the narrative of David, when does that proclamation land on David's shoulders? So it's fair to say we don't know who David is.
Yeah.
And as he progresses in his journey as king, we might start to see what kind of king is he? Is he different? So, again, we don't want to read too hard from what we know about David. Just kind of listen for what's David being presented here in these early days.
It's also possible that we may have pride and conceit, but we're still after God's own heart.
Yeah, in line with what we saw with Samuel, right? It's possible that David has character flaws. And yet, this is one of those paradoxes. He's a man after God's own heart. We don't have to make them mutually exclusive. We can say there's flaws and there's goodness working in the same place. Okay, there's something over here.
I always thought that was his brother's misinterpretation.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's fair. And certainly the text wants you to see David as a hero very quickly, right? But also when we have the biography, we go, well, maybe the hero has tinges that we can watch for in the text.
Along with this comment, I'll just say that I've always interpreted this as somewhat guilt coming out here with his brothers and the Israelite army hasn't done anything about this yet. This is offensive to them, to say the least.
Yeah.
And they haven't done anything about it. They're shaking in their boots.
Yeah.
And David comes up and asks pretty much the obvious question: why haven't you done anything about this?
Yeah.
Kind of like Joseph.
Yeah. Well, that's a similar kind of tone to it, doesn't it? Yeah. But there's this sense of power versus purpose. Which is to say, power being expressed on the battlefield, I'll get you a second.
Okay.
Power being expressed on the battlefield creates an effect. And David is saying, what's your purpose here? Are we here just to run? Do you not identify what he is? I mean, I can hear that pretty cleanly in the text, right?
Where's your courage?
Yeah, where's your courage? Yep.
Well, and jealousy was set up earlier when Samuel came in and looked at all the brothers.
Yeah, that
said,
didn't go
this
well.
This is
did
not it.
It. Yeah.
And they're all there
yeah,
because
yeah.
they sat down and ate, and he anointed him in front of all the other brothers.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, that's good insight. The idea that they've had the demonstration in the chapter before, and David's the one that gets the sanction of the judge.
Right.
Of course, it doesn't have a lot of weight, on the other hand, because what are the people of Israel saying? We are so done with judges.
Yeah.
We are so done. So it doesn't matter whether David's been anointed by Samuel, we're kind of done with that. So Saul standing up, will Saul be the king that they want? David coming in saying, the legacy of the judges is still here. Here I come. I'm letting that play a little bit.
Well, I think he's also a contrast to Saul. So Saul was head and shoulders above everybody else. He's the obvious choice for king. David's still too young to even go to battle. His dad won't even let him go with his brothers.
That's right.
So he's coming to bring them supplies, and all of a sudden he's overstepping his bounds in terms of his authority and his experience and his knowledge. He looks, I mean, I'm sure there's jealousy involved, but he also looks kind of foolish
yeah.
in that moment. Like, don't embarrass the family.
Yeah. It's interesting, boy. Yeah, no, hands are flying. It's interesting to me that the men report back to Saul. In other words, David's doing something, or is registering something to the men that are on the battlefield enough that they say, listen, we got to tell Saul about this kid who seems to think that this is a done deal. Why are we waiting? So, very interesting tension there. But it registers enough in the troops, they go, the king needs to hear about this. For good or bad. Something else? Other comments? Yep.
Our definition of king and God's definition of king are so far apart.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, David was already king in the eyes of God.
Yeah.
Yes.
The people don't even know it yet.
Yeah, there you go.
That's right.
Yeah.
They have not a clue.
Yeah.
And the true king in God's eyes is when God rules through that person.
Yeah. God and the king are very
he rules
transparent.
That didn't happen with Saul.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right.
That didn't happen with Saul.
Yeah.
And so I believe that David being blessed by Samuel in the previous chapter has been blessed because God knows his heart, and he's able to rule, even though he is a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
Even though he is a child.
Yeah.
And so, when we read this, it's difficult for us to read it and dismiss even our ideas of a king as in God. So if I became a king, I would be a true king only if God ruled in my life. Anything else? I'm not the king.
And I would say this,
you
just
know,
that,
just to get you,
yeah,
go
yeah,
ahead.
Yeah.
Verse 13, read verse 13 in the previous chapter.
Yeah, no, you're not playing fair, but go ahead.
The Spirit of the Lord took control of David from that day forward.
Good.
And the Spirit of the Lord left Saul.
Yeah, that's good. That's a key verse that I wanted to ignore just so we can talk
sorry.
About it.
Oh, sorry.
But there is, and I was going to ask this question, so you beat me to it, and then we might as well go home then. How does David know God? So we have the anointing, but I want to go further than that. How does, at this point in the story, does David know God? Does he have, it doesn't seem, but does he have one of those encounters like Samuel had? Was he a boy, and God spoke to him? And it was clearly an encounter with the divine, and it rooted him. Don't have that narrative put out there. So I'm just asking you, because we're going to look for it in the story when we read it here in just a minute, which will be next week, Vicki. Thank you for that. How does David, in your estimation, how does David know God?
He has seen evidence of God working when he's out by himself. When he's wrestled, or the lion, the bear.
Yeah. So, first off, maybe solitude?
Yes.
I went back and read a little around Jesse looking for some kind of hint a faith legacy. The story of Ruth kind of gives you a little bit by proxy. It kind of implies there's a faith history going on in that family. But when you look right around the father, you don't hear this, Jesse was a man of God. You could argue, maybe by the military involvement of his sons, that he was committed to Israel. But if you back up from that and you say, wait a minute, they're going to war with a king that God doesn't want, I'm not sure that's spiritual discernment. He's maybe loyal to what's going on, but maybe not discerning the will of God. So how does David know? Isolation? What else would you say? And we're going to read this next week, so we'll look for it. But what would you say David has currently available that lets him go to this battle line and say what he says?
So he has also a mission.
Mission.
Mission and ambition. Ambition.
Ambition.
Ambition. Thank you. Yes. It's the French, Michelle. I'm so sorry. Ambition. Something else? How can David say what he says about God and what Israel is supposed to do based on what he's experienced thus far in his life?
Well, I think mission works too, because he was anointed.
Yeah,
even
good.
Though he may not know what that means, if he accepts Samuel's words for what they are, he knows he's been chosen by God.
Yeah.
So there is a sense of something also driving him, or purpose.
Wouldn't it be confusing, and I think the story plays this way, for David to be anointed by the judge and there's a king in place, what is he supposed to do? What is he supposed to do with that information? I'm anointed to do what? Am I supposed to be... I mean, I would be confused, I guess, is what I'm saying. About what that would be.
You see him hold that tension throughout the writing.
That's right. Saul. What does he do with Saul until Saul deteriorates?
You run.
He runs when his fear comes, right? But other times he plays the harp to soothe the king that cannot have access to him. So kind of his identity and function.
When he's looking for someone to play, one of the young men said, I've seen the son of Jesse of Bethlehem who knows how to play the harp.
Yep.
He's a valiant man, a warrior, elegant, handsome, and the Lord is with him.
Yeah, there you go. Good. And are you reading ahead again?
No, I'm not reading ahead. I'm behind you.
All right. I'm gonna stop it there. Is that all right? We'll pick up with, because Vicky's pretty much, it's all right. Thank you all. Very good discussion. Very lively. Thank you.
Have a good day. See you next week.
Good stuff.
Good stuff.
Thank you.